Well, good afternoon, brethren. It is a very wonderful opportunity and privilege to be able to speak with you again today. By the title of this tape, I think you will recognize immediately that it is a timely subject. I have not yet printed the labels, but I probably will call this tape something along the lines of Ariel Sharon, the Lion of God. The recent election of Ariel Sharon as Prime Minister of Israel is perhaps the most significant news of 2001, at least thus far. As those who have received material from us at Cornerstone over the years are undoubtedly aware, we've been watching Mr. Sharon with great interest for some time, realizing that the day was indeed likely coming when he could well play an even more vital part in the unfolding Middle East drama in our time. And that day, it would seem, has indeed arrived. A number of years ago, we uncovered a then-hidden story with respect to Deputy Prime Minister Shimon Peres's unscrupulous attempt to undermine the peace process and sell out the nation of Israel, and Jerusalem in particular. His secret negotiations with the Vatican still remain intact, and he has labored tirelessly in both the public and private sectors to advance the cause of encroaching globalism. The murder of former Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin elevated Peres to the highest office in the land of Israel, a position he held for only a relatively short time, but his presence behind the scenes, where he has, frankly, always preferred to operate, is still as strong as ever. In the September-October issue of Cornerstone, we published a lead article entitled Jerusalem, a Cup of Trembling, in which many of the issues regarding Shimon Peres's betrayal of Israel were detailed. At the time this material was actually written, the future of Israeli politics were just beginning to emerge from the mist. Although Ehud Barak's government was shaky at that time, he was able to hold off on forced national elections until February the 6th of this year. Since Mr. Barak assumed power in Israel, he consistently was controlled and intimidated by the influence of powerful international interests and almost always made conciliatory gestures toward the Arabs and especially the Palestinians. His administration was, in a manner of speaking, a slap in the face of Israeli nationalism and a repudiation of the conservative causes within the country and the world as a whole. That Prime Minister Barak would lose this election was something of a foregone conclusion. His contrary stance toward the interests of Israel, in the end, simply could not be tolerated any longer, at least not at this time. But while his removal from office, followed by his surprise resignation from both the Knesset and the Labor Party, may have taken him out of the public spotlight, men like Barak and Peres and others simply never fade away. Like chameleons, they just change their appearance and keep on and on and on in their fawning servitude to the puppeteers who pull the strings. Barak, having made it appear as though he is finished, will continue to work in the background toward the egregious goals of those who seek to inflict political, social, economic, and religious slavery upon the masses throughout the world. There are few more striking examples of the globalist mindset and principles at work than the turmoil that has been created in the Middle East, and especially in the Palestinian demands for statehood and the acquisition of Israeli lands, including particularly a divided Jerusalem. Political considerations aside, however, there's a far more of a reason to discuss these issues with regard to the potential for outright war in the Middle East. Yes, I know there have indeed been wars before in this region, and rumors of wars seemingly forever. But times, my friends, are indeed changing. Things are not the same anymore. the possibility for military conflict is greater today than in the three previous major periods of war in which Israel has been engaged against its Arab neighbors over the last 45 years. In addition, the likelihood that the next Middle East war will far exceed any of the earlier hostilities in pain and suffering and destruction is a given. We continue to move ever more surely into a world arena of greater and greater danger and defeat and difficulty in this present historic era in which we live. I do not, in spite of some of the comments I may have made in the past, I do not subscribe to outright alarmism. But I do want to share with you some very significant factors that are in place at this moment and that directly affect the Middle East and the potential for major war. First of all, Israel has already issued warnings to its citizens to prepare for a hot war and has called up all of its military reserves. At the same time, the Arab states have entered into a mutual defense pact. Without question, Israeli-Arab relations are at the lowest point since the Six-Day War, the problems only exacerbated by outgoing President Bill Clinton's interference in Middle East politics and in other Middle Eastern affairs. His policies in this area were a rank failure of the highest order. Even since leaving office, Mr. Clinton has repeated his call for a divided Jerusalem as the only cure for the increasing trouble between Israel and her Palestinian enemies. The price of oil today is fluctuating at about $29 a barrel, and the predictions are that it will drop, which is a good sign perhaps for you, Mr. or Mrs. Average Consumer, but is not a good indicator for American and British oil drilling interests. President George W. Bush, himself a member of a powerful oil family, is in a position to guarantee that oil prices can be forced upward rather than lowered. How? By engaging the United States of America in a major war in the Middle East. Will he, in fact, attempt to settle his father's old score with the Arabs, inherited when he failed to fully defeat Saddam Hussein in the Gulf War of 1991, a totally contrived situation if there ever was one? The U.S. economy, we need to remember, is now officially in trouble, with a possible recession predicted. Are you aware of the hundreds of key business and industrial corporations whose fourth quarter profits in the last year were down by huge percentages over the same period the previous year? This is one of the strongest indicators that the American financial scene is not pretty or promising. Every time in the last 30 years or more that we have experienced widespread monetary problems, there has been an oil crisis of some kind accompanied by crippling inflation. The situations were always blamed on the so-called oil emergency, but every one of them turned out to be totally contrived for the obvious purpose of raping and pillaging the average American citizen. The oil barons are certainly not relics of the past. They are alive and well today, and are still calling the shots at the top echelons of power in the world. If you understand truly the history of the Middle East in more recent times, you know it is a history of American, British, and primarily Dutch oil interests in that part of the world and the power and influence that they have exerted through the last few decades of time. If there should be a significant Middle East war, we can expect to see oil top $80 a barrel, possibly much higher. It is highly unlikely that U.S. President George Bush will let his oil cronies down, but will in fact respond appropriately to look out for their economic interests. Speaking of the U.S. economy, it has been hit by a plunge in spending on major items such as automobiles and computers and other previously considered secure commodities, resulting in the lowest annual growth rate in 5 years. The anemic performance of the gross domestic product was below even the scaled-down expectations of many private analysts. They were forecasting a growth rate of around 2.2%. But, in fact, the actual rate for the year 2000 was only 1.4%, a major disappointment and setback. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan warned Congress just last week that the economy of the United States has likely weakened even further, saying that growth in the current quarter is probably very close to zero. Greenspan did not rule out the possibility of a recession, saying the country's first real downturn in a decade could occur if consumers become so rattled that they stop spending. Well, that's already happening. Increased spending on big-ticket durable goods, something that economists were depending on lasting for at least the next several years, actually fell 3.4% in the fourth quarter of 2000. The slowdown in the economy has resulted in multiple thousands and thousands of layoffs in various industries. Automakers especially have been hard hit, forcing the closure of numerous plants in an effort to cope with the huge supply of unsold cars. If any of you have access to the Internet, by the way, you ought to avail yourself of the news sources on the Internet, especially in such areas as financial or economic news. I happen to subscribe to AOL, and millions of others do too. Many of you do, I'm quite sure. But even your other Internet providers will have access to world news and, of course, U.S. news. And I know that I find it absolutely amazing what facts are actually reported and made public with respect to the downturn of the economy in the United States on the Internet news services, the financial news services. Often an item will appear only once in a day and never be repeated again. And so it pays to check those a couple of times a day or more if you want to stay informed. Anyway, as I was saying, major drops in housing construction and new business investment, both considered to be key factors in future economic growth, are now seen as harbingers of very difficult financial times to come. This past week, 61 major U.S. companies warned of lower-than-expected first-quarter earnings in the year 2001. That brings the total number of earnings warnings for the quarter, this quarter that we are in right now, to 176 major corporations, almost seven times the number at this time last year. Of the 64 Standard & Poor's 500 Index companies that have issued outlooks, fully 75% have been negative. The worst news comes from the technology sector, where 40 major corporations have issued first quarter earnings warnings. If this trend spreads to other sectors, the U.S. economy is going to find itself in critical trouble. Not only in the first quarter, but at least into the second quarter and possibly the third quarter of this year. At the present time, the U.S. military is actively preparing for war, especially in the Middle East. All American forces there and in Europe have been placed on alert, the threat status having just been upgraded from Bravo to Charlie condition. According to high-level sources in Europe, the U.S. Fifth Corps, which includes the U.S. Army's 1st Armored Division and the 1st Infantry Division, plus supporting artillery, engineering, medical, and supply units, are moving en masse to a location in Germany known as Grafenwöhr, a sprawling training center near Nuremberg. In addition to these rather alarming facts, the U.S. 69th Air Defense Brigade, a two-battalion Patriot missile outfit, is going through the process of deploying overseas, meaning leaving Europe and going to both Israel and Kuwait. Again, highly placed sources have stated that by deploying the 69th Brigade, the European command is basically saying, once the 69th is in place, that this will send an unmistakable signal to all terrorists, namely that the United States of America is definitely taking sides in a fight in the Middle East that all sides now admit is going to be a war. The name of the special exercise to be conducted by the 69th in Israel is being called Operation Juniper Cobra. It's also interesting that in December, Lockheed Martin was awarded a $212 million contract to produce an upgraded Patriot missile. The same source also said that the British SAS Special Forces troops were preparing to deploy in a, quote, desert climate, unquote, within the next 3 weeks. Based upon Chairman Greenspan's last congressional testimony, the Federal Reserve has apparently shifted back to Keynesian economics. Newly elected President George Bush has pledged to rebuild the U.S. military, and the best way to accomplish such a goal in the shortest period of time and with the least amount of congressional resistance is clearly to create a need, namely a war, a reason for being. It is now estimated by market analysts that raw materials and defense industry offerings will replace high-tech stocks as the big moneymakers on the world exchanges over the next several years. These are signs of the times, of the changing times in which we are living. As I'm sure you know, Ariel Sharon is not a man to be taken lightly, either by disgruntled Israelis, Arabs, or Americans. He is the conservative political and military strongman in Israel, and has been so for many years. No one in a position of power in that country stands more strongly for Israeli nationalism. The Arabs fear and loathe this man. His career has risen, fallen, and risen again amidst a swirl of controversy that goes all the way back to Israel's war for independence in 1947 and 1948. He was wounded in that encounter, and later in 1953, he launched the infamous Unit 101 Commando Squad, which spearheaded raids into the West Bank, then under Jordanian occupation. Sharon received the blame for the deaths of 69 people, including women and children, during a raid into Kibya, in which 40 homes were blown up. As a paratrooper in the 1956 Sinai campaign, Sharon was criticized for having a brigade drop behind Egyptian lines at the Mitla Pass, yet he was promoted to general in 1966 and helped to lead the IDF's capture of the Sinai in the infamous Six-Day War. His heavy-handed tactics against Palestinian insurgents, including raids into refugee camps, received disapproval by the weaker, insipid Israeli leadership of that time. But the number of terrorist attacks dropped sharply as a result of Sharon's action. Of course, he was also roundly criticized by the United Nations, by the American government, by British and French government officials, indeed by the world's internationalists, in other words. In the Yom Kippur War of 1973, Ariel Sharon, commander of the Israeli Armored Corps, spearheaded an offensive at the Suez Canal, helping to establish a bridgehead and eventually crossing the canal. The operation is credited with having turned the tide of the war and avoiding Israel losing control over the Sinai Peninsula. Later, Mr. Sharon served in the Israeli parliament, first as a member of the Likud party, then later as head of the right-wing party known as Shalom Zion. He was named Minister of Agriculture under Prime Minister Menachem Begin, and his party then merged with the Likud party. In this office, Sharon oversaw the establishment and expansion of dozens of settlements in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, including Ariel, Shiloh, and the Jewish quarter in Hebron. The settlement campaign nearly derailed the peace talks with Egypt several times, although a treaty was finally signed in 1979, as you well remember if you're old enough to go back that far, when Jimmy Carter was president of the United States. Now, I would like to call your attention to something here concerning Sharon's past activities. When he was the Minister of Agriculture and oversaw these settlements of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, these were not Palestinian settlements. These were settlements of Israelis into what the Palestinians considered to be territory that they deserved or that was their right. And so Mr. Sharon, by these actions and many, many others prior to that and after that, has been a continual thorn in the side of Yasser Arafat and the PLO, not to mention all the liberal voices in Israel and elsewhere throughout the world. After his re-election in 1981, Menachem Begin nominated Sharon to become the Israeli Minister of Defense. But his political star fell when, in April of 1982, he ordered the bulldozing of settlement homes in Yamit just before completion of a Sinai handover to Egypt. In June of that same year, Sharon led an IDF invasion of Lebanon called Operation Peace for Galilee, with the aim of expelling Palestinian terrorists firing Katyusha rockets, Russian rockets. While that goal was successfully met, the IDF became embroiled in Lebanon much longer than expected, 18 years to be exact, with hundreds of soldiers killed. Sharon ended up being forced out of office in February of 1983 after a commission of inquiry found him indirectly responsible for a massacre of hundreds of Palestinian civilians at the Sabra and the Shatila refugee camps near Beirut, Lebanon. In fact, this event now is being brought up by Palestinians all over the area. Remembrance back to the time of this particular massacre involving the then defense minister, Ariel Sharon. At the time, it appeared that Sharon's expulsion spelled the end of his political career, but he slowly worked his way back up the ranks of the Likud party, mainly in the role of spoiler, spearheading right-wing opposition, even to the peace fears of fellow hardliners like Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir in the 1980s. He later served as Minister of Housing and Minister of Industry. Sharon formed a separate camp within the Likud party, splitting the party and helping to bring about its defeat by Yitzhak Rabin's Labor Party in the 1992 elections. Another controversial step that was taken by Sharon during this period was the purchase of a home in the Muslim quarter of Jerusalem's Old City, a place where he seldom, if ever, stayed, and yet which was still the spark that often ignited tensions in the area. This is the kind of man Sharon is. You need to take note of that. Of course, we all remember his presence in September of just this past year at the Temple Mount that was used by the Palestinian militants as an excuse to initiate the Intifada, which is continuing even to this very day. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu named Ariel Sharon as National Infrastructure Minister in 1996 and later as Foreign Minister of Israel, in which capacity he participated in the Y River talks with the Palestinians in 1998. Sharon then succeeded Netanyahu as leader of the Likud party when the Prime Minister lost the election of 1999 to Ehud Barak. It is likely that the Likud party never really intended that Sharon would run for Barak's office, due primarily to his controversy-ridden background and his intense nationalism. I mean, this man went so far once as to publicly denounce PLO chairman Yasser Arafat as a murderer and a terrorist in an interview with the New Yorker magazine prior to his latest political campaign. And this is the kind of outspoken individual that we're dealing with in Israel at this time. It has its good side and it has its bad side as well. It's virtually a given that Ariel Sharon will not be as malleable as his predecessor when it comes to settling issues with the Palestinians and with the Arab world in general. He will be a strong promoter of Israeli national interests and undoubtedly will thwart the Middle East peace process, such as it is, or such as it is called. He's obviously a hawk on military matters and will almost surely keep Israeli forces on alert well prepared, and ready for battle. In fact, Sharon has been one of the few Israeli leaders who has shown the initiative to actually initiate and start attacks rather than waiting for attacks to come his way and then simply retaliate. So you might want to keep that in mind as well. His specialty through the years has been in devising raids across borders, organizing rescue missions, some of them even daring, and shooting first and asking questions afterward. Although some of his positions may soften as he attempts to bring the Israeli government into some sense of unity, do not look for Sharon to give in easily or often to United Nations, American, or Arab demands. Reaction to Sharon's election has already turned violent, with a car bombing occurring just a few days ago, in the first part of February, February 7th, a day after the elections, in fact. You can look for increased tensions both within Israel and throughout the Middle East as the year 2001 unfolds. Of course, it remains to be seen precisely if the new Prime Minister of Israel can successfully pull off some sort of unity in his government. Clearly, he sees the need for a coalition and has taken initial steps in that direction, asking Labor Party Secretary General Ronan Cohen to appoint a team to negotiate a unified government for the nation. It is, however, highly unlikely that Sharon will be able to completely stabilize the volatile situation in Israel and the Middle East. Violence continues to rise sharply, as evidenced by the number of shooting incidents in the West Bank, with Fatah and Hamas leaders calling to intensify the intifada. Indeed, Hamas spiritual leader Sheikh Ahmed Yassin declared that it made no essential difference to them whether Barak or Sharon had been elected, as both have Palestinian blood on their hands. Palestinians protesting the Israeli elections participated in demonstrations held in Ramallah and Hebron. In Ramallah, youths burned photos of Prime Minister Sharon. The demonstrators later continued to the Eosha Junction, where they clashed throughout the afternoon with soldiers. At one point, armed Palestinians in the crowd fired shots at the soldiers, who then returned fire. In Gaza, soldiers foiled a terror attack after discovering a bomb that had been planted next to the border fence north of the Kisufim crossing. The U.S. State Department has issued a travel advisory for all U.S. citizens in Israel, the Gaza Strip, and the West Bank, warning that, and I quote, the U.S. government has indications that there is a heightened threat of terrorism incidents in the Jewish state, end quote. Violent clashes and confrontations continue to take place throughout the region. U.S. embassy and consulate personnel have been prohibited from traveling to the West Bank, to Gaza, to commercial districts of East Jerusalem, and the Old City itself, except for extremely important diplomatic reasons. One source stated, and I quote, when you look at all the signals coming out of Iraq, for example, they are significant. The day after the Israeli elections, Iraqi President Saddam Hussein called for the raising of a 7-million-man army to wage war against Israel. Divisions of the elite Republican Guard have been deployed 50 miles south of Baghdad and near the border with Syria and elsewhere. From all indicators, the source continued, and I quote, it looks like the U.S. is making preparations for conflict in the Middle East. When you see the signals, it looks like 10 years ago, all over again, end of quote. Now, that ought to make a few chills run up and down your spine, because 10 years ago, brethren, was the Gulf War of 1991. Indeed, sources who don't even know each other are all saying the same thing. Pentagon sources said that the heightened tension in the Middle East has prompted grave concerns by U.S. military experts that a Middle East war is in the offing. They said that Washington is now greatly concerned about an Iraqi attack on Israel amid reports that several Iraqi divisions had begun to move into possible strategic attack positions. Sources have also confirmed that earlier reports that Israel is reinforcing its northern border with tanks, armored personnel carriers, and troops in expectation of attacks that would come from guerrilla and terrorist forces in Lebanon. Geopolitical undercurrents continue to point to the rise of a one-world government, in spite of the fact that it has become a cliche and perhaps a butt of jokes among many in the world. But it has been publicly led and is publicly led by such characters as Mikhail Gorbachev and Bill Clinton, but actually run by far higher powers behind the scenes that remain relatively unseen. This is particularly true with respect to the powerful U.S. and British oil interest in the Middle East. It is at least instructive to note that although George W. Bush is listed as the 43rd President of the United States, he is, in actuality, the 42nd to serve, because Grover Cleveland is counted twice. I think the really intriguing thing in this is that ancient Israel had precisely 43 kings before going into demise, or 42 kings, perhaps I should say, before going into demise and captivity. That's an interesting parallel to possibly where we are today, something I think worthy of our consideration. You know, it is always interesting to take note of people's names. We've done that before on a number of tapes and articles in the past. We did an extensive one on Shimon Peres's name and found it in the Bible and found what it meant and were amazed, frankly, at how accurately the meaning of his name pointed to the illicit, underhanded, unscrupulous, and illegal activities in which he has been involved for many years. Well, Ariel Sharon's name is very interesting, especially with respect to names taken from the Old Testament, or the meaning of which has a biblical origin or application. Certainly, a name like Ehud Barak would have meaning. A name like Benjamin Netanyahu would have meaning, and they would immediately come to mind. As I said, Shimon Peres is another example, though not really in a positive light. But this is true of Ariel Sharon's name as well. The word Ariel is in the Bible. I don't know if you've ever looked it up before or were aware of it, but it is. And it has a wonderful meaning in many respects. It means literally the Lion of God. Ariel, the Lion of God. The definition means heroic, and it is used as a symbolic name for Jerusalem. Its use in the scriptures, however, might suggest a rather dismaying turn of events for that great city. Here is what we read in Isaiah, the 29th chapter. This begins in verse 1. And we'll run through about verse 14. Isaiah 29. Woe to Ariel, the city where David dwelled. Add you year to year. Let them kill sacrifices. Yet will I distress Ariel, and there shall be heaviness and sorrow. And it shall be done unto me as Ariel. And I will camp against you round about, and will lay siege against you with a mount. And I will raise forts against you, and you shall be brought down, and shall speak out of the ground, and your speech shall be out of the dust, and your voice shall be as one that has a familiar spirit. Moreover, the multitude of your strangers shall be as small dust, and the multitude of the terrible ones shall be as chaff that passes away. Yea, it shall be in an instant, suddenly. You shall be visited by the Lord of hosts with thunder, and with earthquake, and great noise, with storm and tempest, and the flame of devouring fire. And the multitude of all the nations that fight against Ariel, even all that fight against her and her munitions, and that distress her, shall be as a dream of a night vision. It shall be as when a hungry man dreams, and behold, he eats, but he awakes, and his soul is empty. Or as when a thirsty man dreams, and behold, he drinks, but he awakes, and behold, he is faint, and his soul has no appetite. So shall the multitude of the nations be that fight against Mount Zion. Stay yourselves and wonder. Cry you out. They are drunk, but not with wine. They stagger, but not with strong drink. For the Lord has poured out upon you the spirit of a deep sleep, and has closed your eyes, the prophets and your rulers, the seers, he has covered. And the vision of all that become unto you is the words of a book that is sealed, which men deliver to one that is learned, saying, read this, I pray you. And he says, I cannot, for it is sealed. And the book is delivered to him that is not learned, saying, read this, I pray you. And he says, I am not learned. Wherefore the Lord said, for as much as this people draws near me with their mouth and with their lips to honor me, but have removed their heart far from me, and their fear toward me is taught by the precept of men. Therefore, behold, I will proceed to do a marvelous work among this people, even a marvelous work and a wonder. For the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the understanding of their prudent men shall be hidden. It's a very powerful piece of scripture. Whether this is speaking directly to Ariel Sharon or not, I'm quite sure is an issue that we could debate or speculate on for a long time. I think it is with certainty that this prophecy will finally be fulfilled at the end of the age or the time of the end. Whether it will truly occur in the days of Ariel Sharon is something that all of us should watch, I think, with great interest and serious focus. Even the word Sharon can be found in the scriptures. It conveys a positive meaning, being derived from the word, Hebrew word, yashar, which is defined as to make straight, or to make right, or upright, or to be pleasant, or prosperous. But there are also indications in the Bible that Sharon may well suffer in the days to come. For we read in Isaiah, the 33rd chapter, beginning in verse 3, Isaiah 33, verse 3, at the noise of the tumult, the people fled. At the lifting up of yourself, the nations were scattered. And your spoil shall be gathered like the gathering of the caterpillar. As the running to and fro of locusts shall he run upon them. Behold, their valiant ones shall cry without. The ambassadors of peace shall weep bitterly. The highways lie waste. The wayfaring man ceases. He has broken the covenant. He has despised the cities. He regards no man. The earth mourns and languishes. Lebanon is ashamed and hewn down. Sharon is like a wilderness. And Bashan and Carmel shake off their fruits. The sinners in Zion are afraid. Fearfulness has surprised the hypocrites. Who among us shall dwell with the devouring fire? Who among us shall dwell with everlasting burning? He that walks righteously and speaks uprightly, he that despises the gain of oppression, that shakes his hand from holding of bribes, that stops his ears from hearing of blood and shuts his eyes from seeing evil, he shall dwell on high. His place of defense shall be the munition of rocks, and bread shall be given him, and his waters shall be sure. Deliverance, however great the destruction, is also promised. And that is stated in the succeeding verses of Isaiah 33 with the return of the Messiah, Yeshua HaMashiach, Jesus Christ the Savior. Restoration is predicted for the wilderness of Sharon and blessings for the mountains of Carmel. Repentance and forgiveness is in the offing for Israel, and reconciliation with the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But it's going to be a long and it's going to be a hard road until that time. Maybe the road will not be as long. Maybe it will be a shorter road, but it will be a hard, a difficult, and arduous road. It will take the lives of many in sacrifice. I recently received some very interesting information from a friend in Texas by the name of Michael Turner. I hope he won't mind my mentioning his name. Michael, I think, does yeoman service in gathering a quite wide variety of behind-the-scenes news information and disseminating it via email to those on his fairly extensive list now. So what I'm going to talk about on side two, since I see side one is rapidly running out here, what I really want to talk about on side two, or at least the beginning portion of side two, is really an excerpt from a longer article that Michael sent me, written by Barry Chamish from Israel. Under the intriguing title, why the PLO, and that's the Palestinian Liberation Organization, is, if you didn't know for sure, why the PLO is tunneling under the Temple Mount. Now, Mr. Shamos writes and begins with a bit of history. If you are readers or listeners to the material that we at Cornerstone Publications have sent out over the years, you no doubt are familiar with a group known to history as the Knights Templar. Well, it is this with this ancient order that we begin. I was just about to give you some information on the Knights Templar, written by Barry Chamish in Israel, under the title, Why the PLO is Tunneling Under the Temple Mount. The Templars, if you will recall, were ostensibly a poor chivalric order which disdained materialism until their arrival in Jerusalem in the early 12th century on a papal crusade. 11 knights dug under the ruins of Solomon's temple in Jerusalem for 9 years and finally hit pay dirt. Under the Temple Mount, the Templars discovered a network of tunnels where the Jewish priests hid their treasures from the marauding Romans in 70 AD. The knights not only uncovered some of the gold and silver described in the copper scroll of the Dead Sea Scrolls, but also the records of the first century Jerusalem Church of God. The first bishop of the Jerusalem Church was James, the brother of Yeshua, or Jesus, the Messiah. He was aided by Jesus' other siblings, 5 brothers and 2 sisters. After the Romans sacked Jerusalem in 70 AD, thus dispersing the Jews, the family of James fled to France. James himself had been martyred in about 62 AD, Josephus declaring that he was thrown off the brow of the temple itself. Josephus goes on to laud James as the most righteous and pious of all the early Jewish believers. The descendants of the Davidic royal line had the wherewithal to gain wealth throughout Europe and buy vast properties. Over time, they came to constitute a good chunk of European royalty. While professing whatever religion the state demanded, first worshiping the pantheon of Roman gods and later papal Christianity, they secretly practiced the Christianity of the early Jerusalem church. These descendants of the priestly line now call themselves by the Latin term Rex Deus, kings of God, and passed on their traditions throughout the royal courts of Europe where they ruled. The original Celtic church was founded by the Rex Deus, the kings of God, and St. Patrick of Ireland was indeed a Jew. Other Rex Deus included the powerful Habsburg dynasty, the Stuarts of Scotland, and today's King Juan Carlos of Spain, who, interestingly enough, includes among his many titles that of protector of the holy places of Jerusalem. Moving on to the time of the Templars, which is approximately the early 12th century, they returned from their crusade with vast wealth uncovered under the Temple Mount in Jerusalem and initiated a monumental building program throughout Europe, an undertaking that eventually resulted in the design and construction of more than 250 castles and Gothic churches, many of which remain to this day. Their preceptories are all over France, England, and Scotland. They now challenge the papacy for political control of Europe. Yet, the usually jealous Vatican allowed their power to grow unabated. Why would the papacy have permitted such a group to gain power and sink roots throughout Europe, Britain, Scotland, and Ireland? Now, the answer may be shocking. But it appears that the early Templar initiates discovered hidden documents that totally substantiate the charge that the papacy and the Roman Catholic Church were not practicing Christianity as its founders intended. This information was gained from the literal records of the first century Jerusalem church buried under the Temple Mount hundreds of years prior to this time. Possession of these documents gave the Templars a powerful advantage in their dealings with Rome and unquestionably contributed to their unparalleled success in establishing themselves as the most potent power on the continent for over 200 years. Now, Mr. Seamus writes, a pope with exclusive rights of divine interpretation was not part of God's plan. If the scrolls were made public, they would jeopardize Rome's legitimacy. In the 14th century, the French king, Philip the Fair, finally coordinated a purge of the Templars in cooperation with the Holy See, that is to say, the Vatican. There is a good chance that this event occurred on Friday the 13th in the month of October, possibly adding significantly to the myth of this day being unlucky. Their properties, that is to say, the Templars' properties were seized, and their leader, in fact, the last official leader of the Knights Templar, Jacques de Molay, was brutally tortured until he confessed to the alleged sins of his order. He survived the first round of torture, and a linen cloth was placed over him to absorb his blood and keep him warm. This cloth may be the artifact that has become known as the Shroud of Turin, a fact indeed that has been exposed with amazing corroboration by two researchers by the name of Christopher Knight and Robert Loomis. Although many of the Templars were indeed executed throughout Europe, especially in France, a group of devotees led by the St. Clair clan escaped the French siege by ship and landed in Scotland, a safe haven since it was ruled by the Rex Deus monarch Robert de Bruce. Now, that name ought to sound familiar to you. In fact, it can be established that a sizable contingent of Templar warriors accompanied de Bruce on the occasion of his greatest victory at the Battle of Bannockburn in 1314. As you know, Robert de Bruce, a true descendant of the Scottish royal line, eventually championed Scottish independence from England, a cause that had been taken up successfully a few years earlier by the now famous William Wallace, a commoner whose exploits were colorfully portrayed in the Academy Award-winning movie Braveheart by Mel Gibson. It is also interesting, as Mr. Seamus points out, that it was around this time that pirate ships began to ply the seas. I myself saw this connection a number of years ago because these pirate ships flew or became famous for flying the so-called Jolly Roger or Skull and Bones on their flags. Everyone remembers and knows what the Skull and Bones is. Well, the skull and crossbones is a symbol utilized in Freemasonry and can be found carved into the numerous Templar and Masonic gravestones located in these very same areas, especially in Ireland, Scotland, and England. So it must be noted that at his death, the heart of Robert the Bruce was carried to Jerusalem for burial. Two versions of what happened exist. The first says that the deliverers of the heart were captured in Spain. The second insists that they made it to Jerusalem and that the heart lies buried in the city to this day. The escaping French Templars brought with them the damning scrolls recovered from under the ruins of the Temple Mount and built a chapel in Roslyn near Edinburgh to house them. That's in Scotland. The chapel built by William Sinclair. Now, the name Sinclair, which is a well-known name, actually comes from the name St. Clair, which was that ruling family in Scotland that came from France into Scotland, and William Sinclair was one of the most famous of these, of the Sinclair or St. Clair dynasty, living between the years of about 1415 to 1482. This chapel at Roslyn exists today, and it was built according to the specifications of the Herodian Temple in Jerusalem, and an exact replica of the famous Western Wall, or the Weeping Wall, as you know, was constructed alongside it. to hide their now banned Templar roots, the Knights formed a new front organization. We know it today as Freemasonry. Freemasonry, whose rites were precisely those set down in the Templar liturgy. Scottish Rite Freemasonry spread throughout Europe and included many well-known and very powerful historical figures. It is a fact that most of the founding fathers of America were Freemasons, including George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, James Monroe, and James Madison. That's four of the first five presidents of the United States, the framer of the United States Declaration of Independence, the framers of the Constitution of the United States, as well as its most able diplomat, Mr. Franklin. Some have even gone so far as to claim that the founding of the American Republic was in reality a Freemasonic experiment designed to find a new home in the New World for the secret operations of the Order. If you personally are interested in more detailed information on the possibilities of this very intriguing theory, I would suggest that you request, if you haven't already read it or do not already have it, the May 2000 issue of Cornerstone Magazine, along with the tapes that we have made on Who is Babylon, there are four of them, and the Illuminati, Fact or Fiction. All of that material is available to you free of charge, with no obligation or strings attached whatsoever. I offer this only as a subject of interest to some. Most of you or many of you may not have that intense an interest in that subject. But for those who want to look into it further, there is some good information in those tapes and articles and references to other works that you can access either by buying books or even in library findings or whatever that will enhance your understanding, knowledge and understanding of things that have gone to shape the history as we know it today. While on the surface, it appears that the Vatican and the Templars were avowed enemies, this seems to have been something of a ruse, a cover-up for nefarious activities over hundreds of years throughout Great Britain and the continent. On March the 22nd, 1312, Pope Clement V dissolved the Knights Templar with his decree Vox Clementis, but the dissolution proved a mere formality to further appease King Philip of France, who secretly, by the way, coveted the wealth and the lands and the buildings accumulated by the Templars. More importantly, however, it permitted the Knights in other manifestations to continue enriching the papacy. A subtle provision in the Vox Clementis transferred most Templar estates to the Poor Knights of St. John of Jerusalem, a front organization for the Knights Templar, providing a cover under which the Templars were able to continue operating. In Germany and Austria, the Templars became Rosicrucians and Teutonic Knights. 6 centuries later, as the Teutonic Order, the descendants of the Knights Templar would provide the nucleus of Adolf Hitler's political support in Munich and Vienna. There is no question whatsoever that the Vatican wants Israel off the Temple Mount, and that the Israeli leadership has acquiesced in accommodating its desires, at least that is, up until the elections in Israel, catapulting the ultra-right-wing former Minister of Defense and highly decorated war hero Ariel Sharon to power. The Palestinian Liberation Organization, however, has plans of its own. By the summer of 2000, they began digging under the Temple Mount in earnest. Originally, they claimed they were simply expanding a mosque under Solomon's stables beneath the Damascus Gate of Jerusalem's walled old city. However, the huge mounds of earth excavated from under the Temple Mount told another story. Indeed, artifacts from the Second Temple were being unearthed, some of them actually being dumped in several nearby wadis or streams. On January the 26th, 2001, just a few weeks ago, the Israeli government's television outlet, Channel 1, broadcast a video clip that secretly filmed under the Shrine of Omar, the 7th century building, which may have been deliberately constructed over the Holy of Holies, the most revered portion of the ancient temple. The video revealed a new and massive tunnel aimed directly at the most sacred core of Solomon's and later Herod's temples. The PLO is not only the treasures buried beneath the ancient temple to supply their economically and morally bankrupt regime of terror, but also are attempting to find more of the secret scrolls that can be used to blackmail the Vatican and thus allow them to get their way in world diplomacy. In this regard, I think it is instructive to note that former Prime Minister Ehud Barak, while demonstrating his willingness to concede the surface area of the Temple Mount to the PLO, still insisted on retaining Israeli sovereignty on the ground below the temple. He was willing to give away the top surface of the Temple Mount, but not what was underneath it. Isn't that interesting? Excuse me. The Vatican is terrified that the Jews will eventually uncover the truth under the temple, and they are not alone in their desire. It is therefore essential for them and for many others in power in the world that Israel is removed from the Temple Mount, one way or the other. On January 4th, 2001, Colin Grant published a full-page article in the Glasgow, Scotland Sunday Post. He revealed that the Knights Templar, as descendants of the Davidic line, believe that they have the right to reclaim the Temple Mount as their true heritage. One must remember, if you are familiar with the history of the time, one must remember that Godfrey de Bouillon, leader of the First Crusade, was offered the throne of Jerusalem with all of the respect and power that would accompany such a royal seat. He refused the offer, but his brother, Baudouin, accepted and became officially the first king of Jerusalem. Godfrey was one of the founders of the Knights Templar, and King Baudouin, his brother, was the first monarch to recognize the new order, empowering the members to protect the highways and byways leading into the holy city of Jerusalem. In a most alarming statement, a spokesman for the Milite Templi Scotia, that is simply the Scottish Knights Templar, admitted to the Glasgow, Scotland Sunday Post, and I quote, "We are currently involved in an attempt to remove control of the holy sites of Jerusalem from the Israeli government. We believe they should be administered by the United Nations and are working with the UN and NATO to achieve that goal." End of quote. My friends, a secret battle over the Temple Mount is indeed being waged in Israel today. And unless it can be stopped, this skirmish has the potential of dragging the entire planet into war. Even as I am in the process of making this very tape, violence has erupted once again in Israel. According to the Associated Press for February 13th, I quote, "Israeli helicopter gunships unleashed a fatal pinpoint strike on a car carrying a leader in Yasser Arafat's security detail as the man drove on the outskirts of a refugee camp. The slain Palestinian officer was identified as Mason Ayad, 54, a major in Arafat's Force 17 bodyguard unit. Israel says Ayad was an operative of the Lebanese guerrilla group Hezbollah and twice attacked the Jewish settlement of Netzarim with mortars. Four bystanders were slightly injured in the strike." End of quote. Palestinian justice member Farah Abu Medin said Israel was guilty of war crimes. I quote, and he says, "Israel is a state above the law." End of quote. Also, a 13-year-old Palestinian boy, Bilal Awad, was killed near the Netzarim Junction in central Gaza. Palestinian witnesses said Bilal was shot without warning by Israeli soldiers as he and a group of friends walked along the main road about 500 meters from an army outpost. These latest deaths bring the total killed in the present five-month-old intifada to 391. By the time you receive this tape in a week or two, that total will undoubtedly have risen, and indeed many of the circumstances in the Middle East may already have changed. Aside from trying to form a workable coalition government in Israel, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon also must face the greatest problem of all, that of a future divided Jerusalem. This is the key. We've said that all along. The Bible says that and backs that up entirely. I think we all are acutely and perhaps even somewhat painfully aware of this fact. It is the dispute over this ancient and oft-honored city that is at the heart of the Palestinian situation in Israel. At the present time, there are at least five separate plans for dividing the city and hopefully achieving some sort of peace in the area, including literally separating Jerusalem between above ground and underground, not to mention UN administration and direct Vatican involvement, which, by the way, is a part of a secret plan negotiated several years ago by then Deputy Prime Minister Sharon Peres that we have commented on at length before. In related news, according to the Associated Press for February 7th, CIA Director George Tenet told Congress that the biggest threat to U.S. national security is the Muslim extremist network of the infamous Osama bin Laden, the exiled Saudi who has declared holy war, or jihad, on America. In a detailed assessment of global threats facing the United States, Tenet told the Senate Intelligence Committee that international terrorism is becoming increasingly difficult to combat. Osama bin Laden and his global network of lieutenants and associates remains the most immediate and serious threat. Bin Laden is wanted by the FBI, as you well know, in connection with the 1998 bombings of U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, which killed 224 people. Terrorists are becoming more and more operationally adept and more technically sophisticated in order to defeat the countermeasures that are employed by the major governments of the world. As the United States has strengthened security around government buildings and fixed military facilities, terrorists are now seeking out what are called soft targets. The most dramatic example, recent example, is the October 12th attack on the USS Cole, which killed 17 sailors. Two men in a small boat sidled up to the $1 billion destroyer in Aden Harbor in Yemen and without warning detonated explosives that ripped an enormous hole in the ship and nearly sank it. Bin Laden is the prime suspect in the fatal attack. CIA Director Tenet also admitted that the U.S. faces ballistic missile threats from a variety of players on the world scene, beyond those of Russia and China, specifically North Korea, probably Iran, and possibly Iraq. He said, and I quote, "Never in my experience has American intelligence had to deal with such a dynamic set of concerns affecting such a broad range of U.S. interests. Never have we had to deal with such a high quotient of uncertainty in the world," end of quote. A year ago, by the way, Mr. Tenet said the CIA and other parts of the U.S. intelligence community had identified more than 50 nations, quote, of concern as suppliers, conduits, or potential proliferators of weapons of mass destruction. Libya and Syria rank, along with the other three countries that I mentioned, in the top five in the world. Well, I know that I've got to close here at some point, but I would just say in closing that it may be noteworthy that from August 31st until September 7th of this year, the United Nations-sponsored World Conference Against Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerance will be held in Durban, South Africa. According to Mary Robinson, who is the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. The upcoming conference would lay bare some of the most difficult issues for governments to reconcile, including the legacies of colonialism, slavery, and current forms of xenophobia. If you're not familiar with the term xenophobia, it means a fear or hatred of strangers or foreigners. She said that the Durban UN gathering would force governments and victims to discuss the issues and come up with concrete measures to address complaints and demands of victims, including calls for compensation from years of injustice. Preparatory meetings around the world leading up to the Durban conference have already produced a host of recommendations for governments to consider, including calls for financial and judicial remedies for victims and for governments to adopt anti-discrimination legislation and implement anti-racism education campaigns. Clearly, this upcoming meeting is of great significance in the constant, never-ending push for control of the world's populations. And, brethren, it does not take a prophet or a seer of great wisdom to look at the situation that is developing in the world today, and especially with respect to the position that the United Nations plays in world affairs, to see and to predict that this very subject of racial discrimination, racism, xenophobia, and related intolerance is going to become one of the major issues in the world in the near future. It already is. And there are now laws on the books, both national and international, that have already begun a process of using this as an excuse to control more and more of the peoples of this world, and you will begin to see the implementation of these laws and the results, especially, of this UN-sponsored conference in Durban, South Africa, in late summer of this year. Well, I think it goes virtually without saying that we are living in some of the most dangerous, deceptive, and difficult times in the history of the human race. Those are the three D's. Dangerous, deceptive, and difficult. We could probably add a few more. But those remind me of the times in which we live. Every time I think of those three D's, or just the term three D's, I think of that. You know, 3D is also that special kind of vision that gives you a deep perception of that otherwise flat two-dimensional surface. So maybe that is a little insightful as well. There can, in fact, be no doubt of the kind of world we live in. In many respects, this era is unparalleled and unprecedented with respect to the possible negative factors present within the global society. Never in all of history has the world been closer to the brink as we are at this precise moment in time. A time, my brethren, in which you and I must function as ambassadors for the living Messiah. The near future will not be easy, but rather increasingly arduous for all people, including those true believers upon the earth. How soon are things likely to break loose in some form of devastating event? I tell you truly, it could happen today. It could happen tonight. It could happen tomorrow, or literally at any moment. The stage is set. It is a time for all of God's people to wake up fully, draw especially close to Him, seek for guidance, discernment, revelation, insight, vision, courage, faith, and determination. If we are to survive spiritually for the coming time of even greater difficulty and challenge, then now is the time to prepare our lives. Now is the time, if we are going to survive spiritually what is coming, that we be constantly focused upon the pathway in front of us, and it is absolutely imperative that we be armed to the teeth. Your Bible and mine spells out what the believer's armor really is, and where the believer's battle really is. take note of it. Ephesians, the 6th chapter, beginning in about verse 10. Read that and believe it and cause it to become a part of your life. If we will allow God to get us ready, we, like Gideon's 300, will be chosen to serve in the army of Almighty God, Yahweh Himself, and the opportunity to do exploits in His service will be open to you and to me. Now is the time to throw off any and every restraint of men. Seriously focus your mind and heart, seek for true awareness and repentance, and pray for the igniting of a fire under God's chosen people in this generation that will turn them in to roaring torches of zeal for Him and His purpose. I hope you will take note at the brief information on this tape, and that it will spur you to make yourself more aware, to bring into your life more of the facts of what really is transpiring in the world today. And I hope and pray that every one of us will be jolted out of apathy and complacency and the status quo and the cruise control of life that we all seek to maintain so guardedly in our lives. You know we tend to do that, and I know it. I tend to do it, and so do you. I don't even have to know you to know that the tendency of human beings is to become as comfortable as they can and then to do everything they can to preserve that. If you read your Bible, you will not find a lot of times of complacency and comfort and physical security in the lives of the greatest servants of God throughout history. That's just a fact. This doesn't mean that every moment is a crisis, although for periods of time it certainly could be. But let God instruct you, form you, shape you now. Call out to Him for the forming of His Son in you, because that is what is going to separate, as we might say, the men from the boys. And please, women, do not take offense at that. You understand what I mean, I know. It's going to separate the adults from the children. Now, you can be a believer and be a child. You can be a believer, and you can be grown up and mature and strong. And the difference is how much of Yeshua, Messiah, Jesus Christ lives in you. Not how much you know. Not who you know, not where you've been, not what your credentials are, but how much of the living Savior is actually in you and is acting and producing fruit through you. On the next tape, I'm going to pick up where I left off on the previous tape with a second part on the subject that I started last week or a couple of weeks ago when I made the last tape. And I hope that that is going to prove to be very beneficial to you, because I'm going to get into the nitty-gritty of what it means to be rewarded according to works, what it's going to reveal if you're not already aware of it. Is that the cost of salvation, while it was a priceless price paid by the Father and the Son, also cost you and me. And you and I are going to have to pay a price. We are not shoe-ins for the kingdom. There is something that must be accomplished before we enter. Stay tuned for that subject. And I wish all of you a wonderful week, a great Sabbath as the Sabbath comes to you, and the will of God be accomplished in your life. Look up, for your redemption draws near.